Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey everyone, welcome to the 243rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Matthias Kepler and Working with Lemons. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today, it's another Matt and Oren episode. We've been getting a really positive response from all of you about this, which is baffling because I'm sick of Oren. He must be sick of me.
No, actually, I rather enjoy speaking to you, Matt. It's first time hearing that you... dislike doing this podcast.
I guess that was a hurtful statement I made at the top of the episode.
Yes, and do not edit this one out. Usually Matt is yelling and berating.
Screaming at you, yeah.
And then editor Sarah cuts all that out to make him seem nicer. He has a little bit of like a public image issue right now, some controversies and things. So
yeah, well.
But this is the real Matt.
You reap what you sow. Yeah, man. So yeah, we're going to catch up. We're going to talk about production design, art direction, the nature of collaborating with maybe my very favorite department head, the production designer, the thing that we haven't talked about a ton. So I'm really excited about it. But before we do that, Oren,
yes,
what have you been working on lately?
Well,
15 different things, 30 different things, 100 different things.
100 different things.
Mm-hmm. No, just in all seriousness, how many jobs are you on now?
Right now, this week, I have 2 jobs in production. And then I'm in post on a couple of things. And I actually got asked to write a treatment yesterday. And I said, sorry, I can't write a treatment.
Whoa. Yeah, congratulations.
Thanks. It wasn't like anything. I don't know. It seemed like more work than it was worth. And I've just been really exhausted lately. So it's okay. But I have a really, really, really hard time turning down jobs and saying no. I assume you are the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean job offers. I mean job opportunities. If someone was like, hey, here's a job. Do you want it? It's a lot different than,
you'd
hey,
be like, yes.
Would you like to pitch on this job?
Yeah, I think that we both are a funny mixture of workaholics and naive enough to think that we can make every single job better. And also the cycles of our work are such that like, when it's feast or famine, and when it's feast, like it's an all-you-can-eat buffet, go to town, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Get yourself some filet mignon and some lobster tail, and
yeah. By the way, Matt's a vegetarian, so he has no idea what he's talking about right now.
I have no idea what to eat at the buffet. They're really a waste of money for me.
Well, I hope you're happy. There's no more buffets in the world. Sizzler's out of business
because
of COVID.
Yeah, I really genuinely am not a big fan of buffets anyway, so.
Oh, I love them. So the Sizzler is like the best. If you want to feed a child and an adult for $12, all you can eat, including ice cream, I mean, there's nowhere better. There was nowhere better. Anyway.
Yeah, you're going to eat $7 worth of ice cream.
I will tell you about a few jobs, though, that I'm kind of like in the midst of, because they're why I wanted to talk about art. So I had a shoot 2 weeks ago. I think I might have mentioned on the podcast, but had very specific art needs that were very difficult. And I just felt like the way the agency and our team were interacting was not conducive to making good art. And I honestly don't do a ton of jobs with a lot of very, very specific art direction. And I always want to do more, but to get the really highly art directed, like the Wes Anderson looking stuff, you need to have Wes Anderson looking stuff on your reel. And I don't really have a lot of like highly precise art stuff, you know? And whenever I work on those jobs, I am reminded how difficult they are. And I just happened to have one that shot a couple weeks ago that was quite difficult. And then I have another one that shoots this weekend, actually Saturday and Sunday, that's just like a giant art job. And I'm just like drowning in it. And in the midst of that, this week, I had two shoots. They're for the same campaign, but they're kind of like influencer shoots. And the first one was with an LA-based influencer, so we shot in LA. But because of COVID and because it's for this really big company that has really strict COVID regulations, we had to have a tiny, tiny crew. There was a 7-person crew, including talent, including COVID compliance officer, and including a lifeguard, because our talent was going to go into a 4-foot pool, which, you know, I did not think we needed a lifeguard for, but we did, because those are the rules. So it was those three people plus me, an AD, a sound person, cinematographer, and like, okay, maybe there were more than 7 people. Maybe there were 10 of us.
let me ask you this though. Whatever that number cap was.
Yeah, maybe 10 people.
If say the lifeguard wasn't in that headcount, would you have gotten an additional camera person, for instance, or anything like that? Or would it just have been that your headcount would have gone down?
Maybe. The lifeguard was literally, we were in our pre-production meeting and we're like, yeah, so there's this pool there. And so we rewrote the scene so that the guy like jumps in the pool, 4-foot pool, a very fit, healthy young man. And then the AD is like, we need a lifeguard. And we're like, it's a 4-foot pool. And they're like, we need a lifeguard. So we added the lifeguard on kind of last minute, which, so because of that, they didn't really affect our headcount because we already, like, everyone else was booked. But if we would have allocated for the lifeguard. But so other than that, and then we had a producer. And so, and there was like a location person that came with the house that we filmed in. So what you did not hear me list is any sort of art people. So the art team was me, the AD, and the producer. We were the art department on this shoot.
So a follow-up question there. You were the people doing the art on the day. Did you have a crew member doing the shopping and sketching and all of the other kind of the prep work, basically?
So one of the producers did that, did all the shopping. All the shopping was done on Amazon, more or less. I think we picked up some last minute things at like Walmart and CVS, and we didn't have anything crazy because it was like, the idea is this influencer is purchasing a ton of things for their house, a ton of sports equipment. And so it was stuff that you could easily buy at like a Walmart or a Target or an Amazon.
Right. It wasn't specialty stuff.
Yeah.
Right,
but right. But all the colors of the sports equipment we bought was in the brand colors of the, you know, the company that was paying for this, that we were doing marketing for. So it was stylized in a way. And because the concept was that this guy keeps on buying more and more things, and each scene we shot, we were trying to add more things into the background. And so like an exercise bike, you know, they're not like hard to get props, but they're hard to transfer props. You need a truck, right? And so we weren't even going to have a truck originally, but as the prop list kind of grew, it grew. But I was pretty much the one that was deciding where all the art goes. And, you know, you've been on shoots where it's probably pretty normal for you and the DP to decide, like, let's say you have a scene that has police cars in it, right? And a car accident or something that has like 5 or 6 vehicles in it or 10 vehicles or however many, you're probably involved in where, you know, all those vehicles go. But if you are shooting, let's say, a living room, you're not placing every pot and every blanket and every pillow and every tiny little thing. And I was on that shoot. I was the guy that was like, oh, we can see those wires. I guess I'm going to go and plug those wires and plug them in here and let's tape this. And literally the producer, oh, this is another interesting thing. Do you know what a greeking book is?
Yeah. So, but for listeners at home, a greeking book is basically like a big binder of stickers of different shapes and sizes and colors. And it's there to obscure brands or labels that the company doesn't want to appear in the commercial for whatever reason. So this is the worst example, but say you're shooting a Coke commercial and they had a Pepsi branded refrigerator in the background, you'd open up your Greek book and then you would pull out the sticker that would fit the right size and match the color so that the Pepsi logo wasn't available anymore.
Right. They might have like a blue rectangle that's the same color as the, but I mean, a lot of the shoots, like these shoots that we did, because it's a couple of very big companies involved, like the production company was very big and the advertiser is very big, they just want zero brand name. So we had a grill in the background and it said like Master Grill or whatever.
Coleman or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, the thinking behind that also is that say you didn't Greek it, then all of a sudden Coleman is getting free advertising on this giant platform. The ad team is like, well, guys, I was trying to get Coleman to sponsor us, and then they just got a free placement, and we bought the grill. This is insane. So there is some logic to it, you know?
Yeah, so we call that Greeking, and it's right. Literally, your shoe has like a Nike logo on it. We'll just put a black sticker over it because it's a black shoe, or we had this exercise
shoes are
bike.
Shoes are the things where I get mad about Greeking. Everything else, I'm fine with.
The worst is the freaking Apple logo on the back of the laptop.
That's fine because you can just put a stupid sticker there and maybe it's character based or whatever.
But everyone knows when you have
everyone
that round
wears
gray
Nikes.
Sticker.
It's so dumb. Shoes are so dumb. That drives me nuts. It's incidental and it's purely just some marketing knob being like, well, what if we try to smell Nike?
And what's the deal with Converse? I don't think I've ever worked on a job where the wardrobe person wasn't like, and then we'll throw them on some Converse.
Yeah, well, Converse are great.
Are you allowed to just wear Converse on camera?
They are the easiest to Greek, for sure, because the logo is a white circle with a star in the middle. And so you talk about something you've got in your Greeking book or that you can throw some tape over, frankly, and just artfully mask out. The Converse are the easiest to Greek of all apparel.
Right.
I would say.
So this is like a perfect example of something that seems kind of trivial, but also specialized that the art department
and
takes
expensive.
Care. Yeah. So how much do you think this Greeking book costs?
Greeking books are, I don't know the number, but I know that it is surprisingly expensive.
$300.
Yeah.
This is for a book of stickers.
A book of stickers. Yeah.
$300.
So I would love to see you buy $300 worth of stickers for your daughter and see how many you get.
Oh, yeah. That's like a room full of stickers.
Yeah. Yeah, that Greeking book doesn't even smell like strawberries or nothing.
Yeah, I didn't scratch any of the stickers, but probably not. So the whole departure, sorry for the departure about the Greeking book, but those are kind of those little details that the art department is taking care of.
Our art department also typically, the other things in their kit that they will have are things like saws, screwdrivers, power drills, all sorts of tools.
Yeah, butyl.
Wedges, butyl, yeah, adhesives, dulling spray, all of which they accumulate different colors of tapes. All that stuff is the stuff that you need tiny incremental things of. So, they get maybe a kit fee if they spend use a bunch of butyl or something like that. But for the most part, they're just kind of inheriting it off of other bigger shoots. And it's like, they do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It's no big deal. But for a producer to go out and buy everything that a regular old, moderately experienced art person would have in their kit, that's gonna be probably $1,000,
$40 for some tape. Yeah, but we need six different colors. Yeah, it's crazy. So
and you need to be prepared with every you've got 30 types of colors, you're only going to use one,
right? And the other thing is like a lot of times you'll be standing at the monitor and you'll say like, oh, we have a glare off this picture, can we kind of start rotating it? And you have somebody rotating that picture and you're like, okay, that's great, go back a little, perfect.
What do you say when you
Do you say woof? I don't know.
I say woof.
Woof when you want them to stop rotating.
And people, sometimes they will tease me about it. Just how I learned to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a USC thing. All the USC people I know say woof.
Oh, really?
And scoach. Yeah. Can you just,
I don't say scoach.
And wonky is another USC
janky.
Term.
Janky.
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 Right. Sorry. Janky. Anyway.
Or that's a little jank, which is quite annoying also.
But anyway, sorry, but being everyone. The art department, I had to run and move something and go run back to the monitor and run, all that stuff. And so I kind of had both extremes of the art department experience this week.
Let me ask, though, was it a cinematographer that you work with regularly?
Yeah, it's actually the same cinematographer on all
same,
three of
both.
These jobs.
Yeah. So
but
you could have been like,
for all three of them.
Hey, man, I'm going to go fix this, get eyes on it, and then do it like basically where because he knows what you're trying to fix.
Well,
did you ever do that or no?
No, because those are the types of things where I'd be like, hey, can you tell me, like, Yuki, do you see the reflection? Do you see here? But if it's more of like a, like that, I don't like that lamp. It feels like it's kind of sticking out of this guy's head. So I'm trying to move it a few inches to the right. Instead of me saying like, hey, I'm going to go over here and move this, tell me when it's not sticking out of his head from your aesthetic like pleasure, I think he would be like, well, I don't know. It would just be a long conversation of me trying to explain to him what I'm trying to have him tell me, you know? So as a director in general, I'm very like hands-on with props and art and things like that, because I find it faster sometimes than trying to verbalize what I'm saying. Sometimes I just am at a loss of words to explain my aesthetic displeasure with something.
And we're describing under normal circumstances, we're talking about teeny tiny tweaks. You know, you're like, it's not something that needs a ton of help. You're clocking things a tiny bit. You're scooting them a little bit here and there. You know, it's they're things that you kind of just need to fidget with, basically.
Yeah. But when you have an art department, like a lot of things that we were moving on Monday were plants. Like, oh, this, you know, this side of the frame feels kind of empty, but let's move this plant in. So we just see a few leaves on the edge of frame. But it's like an 80-pound plant, you know? And so here I am like trying to drag it and then run back to the monitor and like, you know, and we were shooting a lot of handheld too, which is the worst for framing things up, because by the time I finish moving the plant, I'm like, oh, it's not in the frame. I keep moving it. And then, you know, the Yuki will be like, oh, I was trying to frame it out. I didn't realize you wanted it in. Like, anyhow, the point is the art department I've grown very reliant on. And when I had to do it myself, it was hard too. So basically, those are kind of three big art things. This thing I'm doing on Saturday and Sunday, I can't probably say what the brand is or kind of what the big concept is, but I can say that it is going to be the longest uncut shot I've ever done in my life. It's going to be one shot that lasts for 17 days, 24 hours a day.
I don't know that you're going to beat that record for it.
Yeah, yes, but, and it's a big but it's not true. It is going to
be... You're not rolling for 17 days.
No, but we are trying to create the illusion that we have 17 days worth of footage and we're going to shoot it all in 2 days. And a big part of how I'm thinking to accomplish it is obviously replaying some clips, but also looping things. So we'll have a character come in and let's say he sits down and reads a book. I can have him read the book for a minute and then I can loop it for 10 minutes, right? And then have...
Are you going to have him... He'll flip pages super fast like Johnny Five and then you slow it down.
Well, your joke, but one of my pitches was like, what if we shoot on the Phantom? And shoot like 10,000 frames a second and then we'll shoot for an hour and we'll have all the material we need.
There you go. You're good to go.
But they're like, what about all the scenes we wrote?
Or blinking.
Yeah. So, but part of the issue of looping things and then replaying scenes and having a character enter, then exit, and then enter again to a scene that you've already played before is you need incredible continuity of the set, right? If he moves a chair in one scene, he has to move it back to its original position before he exits the scene and comes back in order for us to be able to cut to any scene.
Are there any built-in body wipes or ways to obscure the camera that would help you out on this front?
Well, it's funny because all I do is pitch various body wipes. I'm like, what if every time this character enters, he wipes the frame? The shot that we have set up is a little higher. The camera's
kind of impossible to do
at like eight feet in height. So I was like, well, what if the character sometimes carries like a pile of boxes or something that wipe the frame? And we also have this element of a toy train that moves around the room at various times. And I thought we should have it wipe the lens, but it's all like very complicated and very, very, very reliant on the art department to have everything be perfect in addition to having nothing move in the room.
Well, Oren, yeah. I think that there are going to be some cross dissolves that happen.
Right. Well, so, you know, Adobe Premiere has this thing called the morph cut, which is, it's a morph transition where it does little morphs. So if, you know, a chair moved a little bit and you used it, it might be imperceptible, or at least it kind of tries to create the frames in between the two different positions.
What if there was a 17-day lightning storm?
You're joking. You might be joking, but I pitched that exact idea and they're like, no, why would there be a lightning storm? I'm like, because the power can go out. We can have a black frame. Stop acting like my transitional elements are not important. Like literally they're like doing me a favor. The agency is like, well, Oren wants to do these scenes where the camera keeps getting blocked. Okay, I guess we'll let Oren do the scenes. I'm like, are you guys, crazy. This does not work if we don't do these.
They just literally don't understand. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You should just have the main character take a photo. Like, he should have, like, an old, like, a Polaroid. Just anything to basically, well, we're joking, but just to make sure that people understand. Anything where you have a full frame where, like, the camera is wiped in some way would make any edit opportunity, that would create editing opportunities so that those tiny things would be less perceptible, basically.
Yeah. I thought it could be fun if there's an earthquake every few minutes and then things just shake around.
There you go.
Anyhow, but it's,
anyhow, yeah, yeah.
But I guess I'm curious, when you work on commercial stuff or anywhere, any job where there's a client, you as the director usually are the middleman between the art department and the client, right?
Well, you know, I think, yes, yeah. And I think there's an opportunity to kind of talk about this even in broader terms, because there's a few different aspects of collaborating with a production designer or art director, whatever you want to call it. Sometimes people don't like being called production designer unless you're, like, literally doing the schematics of designing sets and stuff. Yeah, sometimes it's if you're just, walking into a location and then doing set deck, sometimes they just prefer art director. Anyway, the point is, there's a lot of different aspects of that collaboration that are really interesting and important to me. Maybe I haven't talked about this on the podcast, but in college, we all had to kind of pick a discipline other than directing, because the way that USC works is, like, you basically have to crew on a thesis film in order to pitch directing a thesis film. And so I was in the theory half of the school, not the production half of the school, but got to, because there were so few people who wanted to be production designers that year, I took that thesis class. They allowed me to, like, step in and take it. And so I, for a long time, was a production designer in, like, college. Like, I was asked to do all of the production design on all the different, you know, big student films and stuff. And so really, I care about production design perhaps more than any other department. And it was a long time before I could really be able to take a step back and be less precious about it, basically.
So you feel like you had to work your way up to being more, to trusting your production designer more.
Yeah, 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 basically. Yeah, like all of the designers that I've worked with, actually, have gone on to do really awesome things. But, like, that first season of Squaresville, I'm, like, pretty darn hands-on. And, like, I'm really lucky that that designer, like, appreciated the collaboration, basically. Anyway, but the point is that all of which is to say, there is the act of client management that a director has to do that's a little bit more like producing than it is directing, in a certain sense. You know, you're just kind of like, if you've got a really pushy agency, you know, at a certain point you're in the service industry and you're just kind of serving their vision, and that can be really frustrating, versus really collaborating with someone on a story level versus on a joke level versus just communicating, right? Like, there's all of these different facets of what makes something good or not in our eyes, you know what I mean? And so I feel like in Bossy Pants, maybe Tina Fey talks about this with show running, like, oftentimes you'd have, like, an art director come in and be like, I found the funniest cake for this scene. And so, like, and it's like six tiers and it's got sparklers on the top and stuff. And it's like, no, it just needs to be a sheet cake that Frank bought at the Safeway. Basically, I'm rambling, but, like, communicating with your production designer and getting them, finding one that has both a great aesthetic sense and also an understanding of what you're trying to deal with from a producerial standpoint, and also then understanding from a character standpoint. That is the holy trifecta, I think, of skills I'm always looking for in an art department head.
Yeah. Well, so how do you... So you did, you know, that Halloween thing recently and that Mountain Dew thing not too long ago. Who sets up what the set looks like and what the props look like?
Well, you know, it's funny. On the Mountain Dew job, it was with Caitlin Williams, who we both work with pretty frequently. And Mountain Dew was funny because it was a crew of all of my favorites. You know, it was people that I'd worked with for years and years. And it was really fun. And so in that case, you know, I think it's Caitlin was there on the scout. I was like, we were pretty quick in terms of collaborating back and forth via like Pinterest and Dropbox and sharing tear sheets and swapping ideas and conversations. But she also has my treatment, which has a lot of those ideas already present in it. But then, you know, on the scouts, we're throwing out ideas. And like in that one in particular, we ended up shifting from a very practical, from a location basically to a soundstage based off of some lighting design ideas that made it, we had to shift to a soundstage basically because of those. And that happened in real time on the scout basically. And she was happy and also really stressed because the job was bid to be a location shoot, and all of a sudden it was a build.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, no matter what Caitlin tells you or any other production designer, 99 times out of 100, the production designer prefers to build a set and to shoot on location.
Yeah. I mean, it was purely budget, basically. It was just like, there were a lot of conversations of like, what sort of flooring can we, like, are we going to see the floor? Are we going to see the ceiling? Do we need these windows? You know, there's some pretty big gags in those spots. There's a guy who like bursts through a wall. That's all done practically because I'm a maniac. Then we're crafting rubber weapons. And like I said, like the flooring, I think, was the big question mark there. It was like, what sort of floor do we need, basically?
Yeah. That's the worst. Production designers are always saying like, are we going to see the floor? Which is a totally valid question, because in many shots, you don't see the floor. Medium shots, you almost never see a floor. Really only see the floor in like really wide shots, unless you're like someone sitting down or you're angled down or whatever. But I'm always so afraid to say, no, we're not going to see the floor.
Well, and I'm sure people at home are like, well, who cares? Just point at the floor. But if you're in a soundstage, A, they're disgusting. And B, well, we were trying to avoid it. Right. Remember, like this was the budget was, and the other set was like way, way, way more expensive. It was like scaffolding and all of like, I can't remember. It was like 40 different Astera tubes and stuff. It was going to be awesome. So it's like, well, maybe you can just paint it, or like, do we have to paint the psych back to the color that it was? What sort of damage are you doing to the flooring? How much is it going to cost to repair all of that stuff? Which is kind of really, it segues into the point you were making before of like, sometimes these decisions feel very simple and it's easy to Google Home Depot, you know, sectional floor and like just kind of slap them together or whatever, and then you're good to go. And that's what, you know, a person could think sometimes, but there's so many other aspects of getting those raw materials to the location and what you are pulling a person off of in order to get that done.
And that's the thing that I struggle with the most. And I'm sure production designers that I work with also struggle with me, in that it's really easy for us as like civilians to say to the production designer, oh, you know, what I just thought would be cool is if we had like a bunch of plants, you know, like on those shelves in the background of that location or whatever. And they'll be like, okay, yeah, we'll see about that. And then you go on like homedepot.com or whatever, and you start picking plants and you start sending them links and you start doing that. And you start kind of trying to shop for them. And I think that's really frustrating, because when you send your art person just like random links of things they can buy, like you think you're helping them, but really you are like kind of changing the way they work for them. And they have to either say, no, I'm going to do it my way, or they just have to do it, and you're kind of ruining their flow. And I think a lot of people don't understand that part of the art department directing department relationship.
I think that plants is a really perfect example of something where you can say plants and think to yourself, oh, I want a fern. And they can think, oh, okay, they want a palm frond, like a palm bush or something. And those are two drastically different plants, right? And so I think that very quickly you just have to start having conversations. And ideally, you know the name of the plant, or at least can describe its height and like leaf color, and is it reflective or not? You know, sometimes, you know, like a fig tree can be like really reflective, and sometimes that can be a bummer or whatever. Does it have to be real? Does it not? But so like the quicker you can start engaging in those conversations, and as a result, I think you end up learning terminology and the aspects of, you know, the different like home decor and things like that very, very quickly. So actually one of the things that I like to do with a production designer early on is explain where these characters shop, because I think that that as a guiding principle, it's a lot easier to just be like, these characters shop at Urban Outfitters or CB2. You kind of get it pretty quickly. Like, is it bohemian? Is it modern? Is it upscale? Is it downscale? Those sorts of things. So you kind of have to learn your own way of communicating with someone so that they're honing in as quickly as possible with what style of art you're looking at, whether that's a plant or furniture or anything else, you know?
Yeah, it's tricky. And I think in advertising, it's like just way more difficult because you don't have the characters in the story that you would have in like a narrative thing. You know, so like in a narrative piece, you can say like, well, you know, this character, she lives in this house that she inherited from her parents, and it was built in the 70s. So everything kind of feels 70s in it, you know, and she bought a few things, but she doesn't have much money. So she has her microwave and her like TV and everything else is old. And she goes here and her door doesn't work. And that's frustrating. Like in a commercial, it's like, well, you know, Coca-Cola doesn't really like anything blue in the frame. So nothing blue. Now they want it to be aspirational. They want people, you know, people that drink Coke, they're great, but they're not rich. You know, we did some focus group testing and people were really turned off by rich people. You know, like
if I had a dollar for every time someone said aspirational on a commercial job, especially when talking about art direction, but about anything, about locations, about wardrobe, all of that stuff, I'd be rich. So that was the thing that I think is a little frustrating about commercials, is that it's always supposed to be the very nice but seemingly attainable version of someone's life, right? So like this Mountain Dew job I just did at the before lockdown was like about gamers, and so we built this awesome loft for these Twitch streamers, and let's like, you know, it's like a little industrial, like I kept making jokes about Wayne's World 2, the loft that they live in Wayne's World 2. But it's just kind of like that idealized downtown LA loft that, you know, costs like $1 million. It's like, oh, you have this whole abandoned doll factory has been turned into this bohemian, you know, posh gamer palace. And they're both Twitch streamers. We're literally, we know what their apartment looks like. They've got a beefed up gaming. You see it on Twitch for 6 hours a day. They're on a card table in a you know, two bedroom in the valley with white walls behind them.
Yeah, it's crazy. Remember, you know, I did this Five Gum spot with Lily Pichu. She's like a Twitch streamer. And we were originally going to maybe have her shoot it herself. And then we're like, well, maybe we'll send like a two-person crew to her apartment or to her house where she lives. But her room is tiny and it's all white walls. And like, what's the point of us going to an all white wall room? What if we just build her walls that you see from her webcam on a stage, and then there's, you know, the social distancing, we can get a bigger crew, we can do it safer. But part of the challenge was trying to build an identical copy of her room that was just much more cinematic, you know, more aesthetically pleasing. So it's interesting. You know, one of the things is lighting. You want to build it in a way where you can light the middle of the room and keep the light off of the sides of the room. And in a white room, it's hard because white, you know, absorbs a lot or bounces a lot of light back.
So, did you ever think about doing washes on the wall?
Like light washes?
Yeah, because that's the other thing that I think of sometimes is like if the room is big enough that you can get your subject and your background to be two different tones, I think sometimes like a stylized wash can be a way to make a wall look cool.
Well, I guess we didn't. My approach was to try to make it look like her room, but with just slightly like less messy. I mean, to be honest, her room, anyone that sees her stream, there's just like crap all over the place. There's dirty laundry. There's things.
That's what I was getting at. I love to mess up a set. I love to like make it feel lived in. And like on that Mountain Dew job, during the show and tell, like client was walking around and all of a sudden they got rid of all the dirty clothes I had on the bed and you know, pizza boxes and stuff.
I don't know. So to me, I find art like really hard, to be honest. I saw this, I went to the premiere of Foxcatcher, the movie.
I love that movie. I was just thinking of it. Commercial director Bennett Miller, his second film.
Exactly. So Bennett Miller, because it was the premiere, Bennett Miller was there to present it.
You know, my wife was in a Bennett Miller commercial.
Oh, yes. I think our friend Avi was also in it for Nikon, right?
Oh, that's
with
right.
Ashton Kutcher, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, paid my rent for a year.
Yeah, thanks.
During the first recession,
Bennett,
of our lives. Yeah, genuinely. Thank Bennett, if you're listening.
So the premiere...
We'll finally have you on the show, but...
yeah.
Thanks again, buddy.
So the premiere was at the AFI Film Festival, and it was a year after it was supposed to premiere at the AFI Film Festival. So they actually didn't premiere when they were supposed to because he said he just felt like the movie wasn't ready yet, and they spent another year in post on it before he premiered at AFI. And he said, he kind of told that story. He said, you know, you're just trying to get it perfect. And he said to me, directing is about taking that image in your head and putting it right next to the monitor and trying to get those two to be as close as possible to each other, which is a certain style of directing. It's like a very visual style of directing.
I love that as a idea. And I also tend to call bullshit on it a little bit. Because I think that, and I know this isn't the point you were trying to make, but like there's, that eliminates the opportunity to be surprised or inspired by something that's happening on set. That to me implies that you have a vision, you wrote the screenplay or you read the screenplay and you storyboarded it all out and you figured out how to make it perfect. And then you walked onto set to try to implement that perfect ideal. And that I disagree with.
Yeah. I mean, I think people have their own way of doing things. I mean, like Michael Bay is famous for being opportunistic. You know, he'll have somebody set up a shot for like 6 hours and then realize like, oh, wait, the sunset's amazing behind us. Let's turn the whole thing around. And that's why his crews often are quite frustrated with him. But he's really good at just finding the opportunities and going for them. And obviously he does some very calculated, specific, explosive work. But I think Bennett Miller maybe is a little bit more of, and I don't know him or anything, but like I would guess based on his work is that he has kind of like an image in his head that evokes a certain feeling, maybe like a composition that's very symmetrical or that's very stark or that shows power relationship or something in his head. And maybe it's not exactly like what, you know, it is exactly on the edge of frame, but more of just a feeling that he gets from that frame, and he wants to look at the monitor and get that feeling from that what he sees on the monitor.
And maybe there's opportunities to be inspired but still get closer to that feeling.
Well, for sure you can get inspired by performances and things, but I guess I doubt Wes Anderson like comes up with a ton of random like visuals on set, you know. So to me the art department is like that. And you know, you had mentioned the treatment, like we show these treatments to people to get the job, right? And you know, one of the biggest tools to get a job is to show these amazing, amazing visuals in your treatment. The problem is a lot of times I'm showing images from a $2 million commercial campaign, and now I have to replicate it for $200,000. And of that $200,000, like $30,000 is going to the art department. And they already have to get me two cars, build the set, rent the stage, do that. Like, so by the time we get to like props or painting or, you know, the color of the scenic work or whatever, it's like we have no money or no time and no labor left. And so now I've set my standards to this $2 million commercial. We have a tenth of those resources. And I find that it's hard for me to feel like fully satisfied. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to find a way to get jobs without pitching things that are totally ridiculous for the budget.
Well, I hear you 100%. And I think that there are listeners at home who are thinking to themselves, well, yeah, I could buy the, you know, $6,000 couch for my set and put everybody in, you know, $1,000 sweaters and all of that, and maybe it would look a little bit better. Or I could go to Target and get the lamp that looks almost as good and light it really well, right? And I think that that mentality is right on and it is true. And like, you know, if you look through either of our work, our very favorite spots, I guarantee you there's a lamp from Target in the background of any of them.
Yeah, right? That's my signature move, the lamp from Target in every shot.
Lamp from Target. Caitlin does say, she always jokes that every commercial, the character is actually just a commercial for Target because half of the set deck is from Target.
Right. That's like that Tide Super Bowl campaign. This is a Tide ad.
yeah, exactly. But what you really, I think that the thing that maybe you're frustrated by specifically recently is that you're a comedy director, and so oftentimes you hear a new joke or there's a new pitch for something, and that if it art is part of it, that's probably a sight gag. And so it's not just that you can go to, it's not cut to a character holding a funny lamp, it's cut to, you know, a character with a talking lamp, and then all of a sudden that's not something that was spec'd out in your job, basically. And, you know, your team is now trying to figure out how to fabricate a talking lamp, you know, 36 hours before you guys shoot, when they were originally going to be working on a bunch of other things that maybe would make the aesthetics a little bit cleaner, right?
Yeah, and guess what? It's going to be a pretty half-assed talking lamp if you have 36 hours to figure it out.
I've told this story, I think, probably on the show before, but it bears repeating. I had done these cat food commercials where kittens were going to college. And so we had fabricated all of these scale models of basically kittens, like kitten scale models that were like as though kittens were going to like Oxford, you know, or Cambridge, like a very like old world British, dark, like deep dark woods, mahoganies. We had like a rugby pitch, you know, it was that sort of vibe. And my production designer at the time had done all these really incredible mock-ups and stuff, and we had literally every like model builder in town was working literally overnight to get these sets ready for us, and they were beautiful. It was incredible. And we were able to get a lot of American Girl dolls were basically the exact right dimensions relative to what we wanted for kittens. So we could like order lockers and all sorts of stuff. So it was kind of this perfect combination. And they also had like a really big array of the sorts of props we needed, because we had a music class and then we had this and that. Anyway, so I had I was just so stoked. Most of this job is art, right? And the work is really, really good. I'm so happy with it. And there was one of the spots was about a foreign exchange student. And I think this was my pitch even. I think that the whole spot was my idea. But I was like, oh, we'll get a French bulldog. He'll be the foreign exchange student. What a great dumb pun that is. And we had like I said, it was British. So I had them build a double-decker bus, like the red, like, you know, buses you see like in Harry Potter or whatever. And it was built to specific specifications so that the dog could be safely put inside without hurting it, but also we could leash it to the thing, and all, like, we had SPCA inspecting it, all this crazy stuff. And then the day before the shoot, the agency asked me to turn the double decker bus into a single decker bus and paint it white instead of red. And I kid you not, we ended up having to, half of it ended up being foam core on one side. I literally almost cried. I said, you guys are making this less funny. And my voice cracked.
Oh, yeah.
I was so upset.
I say that about 100 times a shoot. Yeah. No, man.
Yeah.
It's art department is just, it's just such a hard job. And like, it takes so much labor, and nobody, like, these agency folks can just be like, oh yeah, and then his chair falls apart. Yeah, easy. And you're like, well, chair's falling apart. Like, what's the big deal? You chop the chair up, you glue it with like glue stick, you have him sit on it, he'll fall apart. Perfect. You're like, yeah, but how is it gonna fall apart? Like, I don't know. One of the biggest things people are always writing random confetti explosions into things, especially in advertising, because it's like, oh, it's unexpected, it's a confetti explosion. And it's like, dude, getting a confetti explosion to look amazing on camera is actually not that easy. A, and B, it's a real pain in the ass to reset after a confetti explosion. It's just, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just like going through a phase right now where I am frustrated that I feel like I'm sometimes letting clients down because we can't deliver the things that they want. But the things that they want are totally unrealistic, and I'm trying to find the tools that I can get ahead of the client desires. And so one thing I've been doing recently is, you know, many of our listeners know, is I've kind of recently gotten into Blender, the 3D rendering program. And so I'm trying to create the visual, like literally the second I get the job, I'm trying to kind of mock up the set and trying to kind of come up with camera angles and show them both to the, well, to the production designer, to the cinematographer, and to the agency. So everyone is like on board with like what I'm going for, and they can stop me before I go too deep. Because with art, you can, like you said, you can just spend so much time. I told you about that time we built the $15,000 miniature golf course that they decided to change the night before the shoot from golf to baseball. And it's like, well, it just, so much labor goes into art that nobody appreciates. And I find it frustrating. And you, and they'll compare it to like a $2 million smuggler commercial or something. And they will ask why you can't do what they did. So,
yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things worth kind of unpacking before we head out. A lot of what I think you're dealing with is like, we all as directors, as filmmakers, it's the most important to us that the thing that we're making is good, right? I don't think that there's, we've never met a filmmaker in the 5 years or 6 years of doing this podcast that would ever be like, yeah, it was fine. I didn't care. So I just did the easy thing. I think that those people don't, either they don't work or they don't exist, frankly. So it's always the hardest for us because we want it to be as awesome as possible. And we also have the best understanding of what all of your collaborators are doing. We're in it with them, you know? And so that's tricky. I think the other thing that you're talking about is that as a comedy director, if you do art, art becomes a part of the gag oftentimes. And so that's, funny art is really tricky.
Yeah, like, it needs to be executed perfectly. It needs to
perfectly.
Be perfectly. So actually this job I did last week, the production designer, I forget what we wanted. We wanted like a giant painting made out of coffee or something. I forget what it was, but the production designer said, okay, just so you know, that's about 40 hours of design work to get that to look broadcast ready, you know? And then the producer's like, okay, we'll find something else. You know, because yes, it's going to take an entire one person working full time for a week to make this one prop for it to be good. Otherwise, it'll just be like crappy.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of the best arc directed spots that we have seen, the thing that's funny is the tone and the performance, and the art direction is almost an afterthought.
Or it's just really focused. It's like, here's the visual gag, and this is the
gag. What I mean to say, it's in the background. And so the people who are working with you are paying attention to the things that are going to make it funny. And therefore, because there's not anything that's explicitly a joke, you can kind of like get away with dialing it in exactly to your vision without them interfering quite as much. But I think also the other thing that, you know, we keep talking about the producerial part of directing, a lot of it is just like setting expectations and digging in as quickly as possible. So I wanted to ask you about your Blender renderings are getting super duper detailed.
I prefer to call them Blenderings, but yes.
Just to paint a picture for people, Oren is like, he's got like a character and he's built out the set and he's lit it and all that, but it is not photo real. It's kind of, you know, in that sort of like early Pixar era of sort of like realism, wouldn't you say? I guess certain things, the car thing you did was actually pretty darn photoreal, but there were certain the less,
yeah,
glossy,
the human
shiny, the texture,
are...
human characters, you know, the fabrics, things like that are not as photoreal as, say, a car is.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Like on this thing that I showed you my render recently, like I found a lot of 3D models online and some of them had textures, some didn't, some I had to make myself. So like, it's like, oh, I found this amazing chair, but it's just a shape of a chair. So I just make it brown. So that doesn't look photoreal, but then I'll find something else that has like all the, you know, displacement and bumps of a fabric. So I have, it's kind of a mix of things that could look photoreal and things that are totally CG looking.
So for your purposes, and for anyone who's technical and understands 3D graphics in any meaningful way, you get that it's just effectively a drawing.
Yeah, right? it's like storyboards, I guess, in a way.
I think it is a super, super valuable tool. I would be hesitant to show it to some people who maybe have a less trained eye because of the issue of it being kind of in that uncanny valley. Like, have you ever had people like look at it and be like, oh, wait, it's not going to look like this, is it?
I've had people, I mean, the response I get more is like, ooh, why don't we just do the whole thing in post? But I do get like, wait, so is this the color the wall's going to be? And I'll usually say like, yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Do you not like it? We can look at some other colors. And to me, it's like, or they'll be like, oh, I thought this, you know, all these mailboxes were going to be filled with mail, but they're empty. And I'll say like, oh yeah, I didn't have time to put the mail in, but just literally that two sentence exchange makes me know that this is something that's important to them. And if I disagree with them, I'll be like, you know, but I actually thought it makes more sense if we don't see the mail, because like this is a lonely character and he never gets mail or whatever. So I have found a lot of people are hesitant because like that render I sent you of this set for this weekend, like our producer was like, I'm not going to show it to the agency. I just don't want them to like start asking me about like, is this the chair? Is this the this? And I think to your point, it's like not fake enough. Like it's not storyboard level enough.
Right.
To.
And that's what I was getting at is I like to show them storyboards. They're black in black and white. They're cartoony. The board artist who's my favorite is a literal cartoonist. Mm-hmm. You know,
Mike, who I worked with last week. Yeah,
great time, right? My favorite. Anyway, shout out to Mikey. I either go storyboards, completely cartoony, and then the actual real chair or whatever actual specific props I want, like photos from the prop house. From Amazon, what are the things that we're literally buying, and anything in between, I get pretty skittish about showing. Like, I don't want to show some with wardrobe. Sometimes I'll show references, but like,
well, you know, see, I've had problems with that. Like today, so we're building the set, and we want to have a fireplace in it, and we have three different options of fireplace mantles that we can rent to build into our set. So our production designer, Caitlin, sent us three different pictures. Like, these are the three I think are good for the set. You know, let's share it with the agency. And like, they're pictures that somebody took. They walked to the rental place. They took pictures on their iPhone and they sent, the lighting is horrible. There's all sorts of other crap all over the place. They're kind of dirty. You know, there's like, it's a fireplace. So in the middle where the fire would go, there's like a hole and there's other things that you can see through the hole. And we shared it with the agency and they're like, absolutely not. We hate all these fireplaces. And I was like, okay, this fireplace is perfect, but I'm going to have to Photoshop it. I'm going to have to put a fire in there in the hole. We're going to paint these bricks that are part of the fireplace. So I'm going to paint them in Photoshop. I'm going to add these other elements of decoration around the mantle like we're going to do. And then I sent it back to them and they're like, oh, okay, approved. Even though it's like a total, it is that uncanny valley type of thing. But they just, sometimes those pictures, it happens with wardrobe all the time too. You send them a picture of wardrobe that's perfect, but it's not in good light. The actors aren't wearing makeup. Everything's...
Mm-hmm, they're frowning.
Yeah. And they're like, yeah, she doesn't look good in that. And you're like, well, yeah, because the lighting's bad. Like, everything... ours will look better. Just... So, I don't know. I find that, like, the more I can... what's nice about doing it in 3D is I can look at camera angles also, and I can start making my shot list out of those angles, and I can discover new things, not on set but on my own time. So yeah, it's a ton of work, but I find it helpful for part of my process. But at the end of the day, like with my rendering for the set for this weekend, I talked to Caitlin. I was like, look, obviously I'm just downloading 3D models off the internet and arranging them in a room. I know you're not shopping these things, but let's look at this.
To be fair though, that's obvious to Caitlin because she is a person who works all the time. That's not obvious to everyone,
right? Yeah. And some of the things
like
that
if you explained like, oh, this is how I'm like, I go to a library and I pull these 3D models and then tweak them a little bit. And some of them have textures and some of them don't. You're probably over people's heads already. Yeah. But that's neither here nor there, because I think in general, it's an awesome thing that you are doing. What I'm really trying to get down to separate from your process is the way that one communicates, not just with client and agency, which is the thing that we've been focusing on a lot recently, but how you communicate with all of your department heads, basically. And I think before we wrap up, just kind of thinking about the relationship with the production designer outside of a commercial agency client relationship, where you do get to dig in a little bit more on character and things like that, and where you are the final say, right? A little bit more, or maybe an EP or something, but somebody who is not preoccupied with, you know, a product specifically.
Right. Or a client.
How does that, or a client. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, just like, we're not worried about making this seem aspirational. How does that change your approach to communication? And
oh, it's totally, totally, totally different. Well, first of all, you know, we try to find that we try to let the character in the story lead the approach, obviously, kind of the stuff we were talking about. But also, to me, it just totally changes my relationship between me and the production designer, because in that place, let's say I'm working with Caitlin or whoever, I will say like, hey, this is what I'm thinking. What are you thinking? And we'll start kind of building things together. And she, like, oftentimes, like, the production designer will totally change my whole thought. Like, they'll pitch me an idea that I like better than my own idea. And we'll do that. And it'll be awesome. And we'll be working together to build this thing together. Which, when I'm the interface between the client and the production designer, it's totally different, because I actually have to, like, stop the production designer from coming up with ideas that are too different from what I've already told the client that we're doing. Because if I change anything too much, it sets into motion the series of dominoes that just everyone gets freaked out. Like, well, we told them it was going to be yellow curtains, and now you're saying they're going to be blinds. Like, oh, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, so
I have lost confidence from important people because of decisions like that before.
Yeah. So it's, that's why people love narrative, and that's why people like directing and being the final say, because you get to collaborate and make, you know, for lack of a better word, art together, and you're really building on each other. And that's like, that's just like the dream relationship, you know? And that's why I think, you know, when you're making a movie or a short or something, you get to do that together.
You're still dealing with the limitations of budget and time and labor and all of that, though, you know, so I think that,
right, but you're on the same team, you're on the same side of that coin of like, well, here's the budget, here's the labor, here's the this, whereas when you are servicing a customer, they want to get as much as possible for as little money as possible, you know.
Yeah, I think some of that, I think you're maybe your recent experiences are coloring that a little bit, you know. I think that is certainly true, but I think that oftentimes, if everyone is on the same page from the get-go, I think that there's still room to kind of enhance and grow based off of those seeds. It's when you want to make a hard pivot that then things get really tricky. Yeah. And then you have to not just fall in love with an idea, but then sell other people on it.
Right. Yeah. And that's... Yeah, it's always
but there are always there's always stakeholders. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you were, you know, in a session where you're like going through magazines and like talking through Pinterest boards and all that stuff with your production designer, and then you're like, yeah, instead of a hot tub, this is going to be an Olympic sized pool now. Awesome. What a good idea. And then you go over to your cinematographer and you're like, hey, we got to change it up. And you go to your locations manager and you're like, hey, we got to find a different spot and all this stuff. People are still pissed at you. Like, they're like, well, great. Well, I don't have enough light now. You know, I spec'd this for, you know, a hot tub, not for an Olympic sized pool. We're going to need the X, Y, and Z. You know, there's still going to be people who are pissed at you, basically. And so I think that, yes, you're all doing it because of character motivations. And so ideally, we're all aligned that's the best thing to do. But if people disagree with you, they disagree with you, and that can be a pain in the butt from any stakeholder.
Yeah, I guess I think as a director, like, if you're changing a location because of something you figured out with a production designer, then like you go and you say to the DP, hey, we had this awesome idea. Like, what do you think if we do this instead of this? And you go to the producer and you're like, hey, how hard would it be to change this location? You know, you can kind of do the politics of it, but it's much harder with the doing that with the agency and the client, I think.
I think you can do that with agency client that tends not to be as feasible just because, you know, there's a couple gatekeepers there.
Yeah. And there's a, oh, we already sold this idea through, or this was already approved, or legal already said you can do that thing. Well,
I don't know, man.
Please. Yeah. I'd love to hear from our listeners about like kind of how, like if they have any tips or strategies of how they work with the art department. Like, I don't know, my dream is just to have millions and millions of dollars go to the art department so we can just build crazy worlds. But until then,
I like a location. I like a location too.
Yeah. I mean, we can build crazy worlds on location as well.
You can do that. That's true. That is true. Yeah. Well, if you have a crazy production design, art direction story, leave us a voicemail about it. I'd love to hear some stories from the trenches from all of you listening at home or in your cars. And probably no other places, I hope.
Yeah. And maybe we'll have some production designers on the podcast.
Yeah, that'd be a treat. Drop us a line at 262-SHOOT-1.
Yeah, that's the number. 1-262-SHOOT-1. And yeah, we will respond. Hopefully. I will respond.
Hopefully.
At some point.
I've been responding to more lately. Yeah, no. But
we're responsive in bursts, but we love all that. We read everything. We listen to everything. Just know that if you send us email or message, we did get it. We will try to respond. By the way, if you're a $10 patron and have not received your hat yet, it's because our hats are on their way. We just had to reorder them, but you will receive it. I apologize for any delays. But yes, we love to hear from you. You guys are awesome. Before we end the episode, I would like to see if you're cool with making an unpaid endorsement.
Unpaid endorsements. I got a couple, actually. One is for you specifically, Oren.
Mm-hmm. Listening.
Came up because of our conversations about body wipes. Do you know the film Rope? The old Hitchcock film Rope.
Oh, yeah. 10 minute takes that are seamlessly cut together. Stringed
That's
together,
correct.
Perhaps.
String to ooh, look at you, look
Roped
at you go.
Here, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a treat. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I'm sure it holds up. But yeah, it is infamously the oner, Hitchcock's oner, basically. And there's a few really funny opportunities where he does like a body wipe to like stitch together the scene so that it all feels continuous.
Yeah. I heard he ripped it off from 1917. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, it's fun because the wipes are so overt that I remember watching it with an audience in film school, and there were a few edits that got actual laughs out loud.
Oh.
But it's
I actually
it's,
might have never seen it, so I'll check
dude,
it out.
Dude, it's super fun. It's like really, it's delicious is the way to describe the movie. It's like, you know, it's got all of the best things in a Hitchcock movie. It's got a little bit of suspense. There's some foul play afoot. But yeah, it's really fun. You would enjoy it very much.
Yeah, and it's a fun movie to untangle.
Yes. Hey. My next one is the show How To with John Wilson. Do you know the show, Oren?
I don't. I don't even know John Wilson, to be honest.
Me neither. You wouldn't. One wouldn't. He is a kind of an introverted documentarian. This is the new HBO show, executive produced by comedy legend and my personal hero, Nathan Fielder.
Oh, cool.
And it's like found footage isn't accurate because basically this John Wilson has been, you know, shooting things for years and years and years. In the second episode, he shows like his wall of like DV tape and videotape and stuff. So he's just got this insane archive of just small found moments in New York City. And then they're kind of strung together through like a thematic idea and voiceover, but it's really quite charming and funny and strange and sad and like explicitly New York City in a way that's really great. And also because we're still not really getting out very much, it's like a nice brush of fresh air to be reminded of like what it is to live in a city that is alive.
And it's a comedy? So,
yes. Yes. Yeah. It's firmly a comedy, but it is quiet and melancholy and effectively about John Wilson, you know, teaching people and learning how to be an effective human being. It's really interesting. It's fun. Yeah. And my last one is a short on Short of the Week called Emergency Action Plan. That is really great. It's by it's a dark comedy by a director slash writer slash editor slash star, Dylan Redford, and it's really interestingly cut, and he seems like a pretty unique, weird voice. And it is about a person who becomes obsessed with what to do in an active shooter situation. And what his emergency action plan would be. But it's kind of about a lot more than that. It's about like radicalization and like, you know, the way that corporations are trying to deal with shooting and like, I don't know. There's a lot to unpack, but it's strange and funny and dark all at once. So
is there any zigzag running in it?
Yeah, actually there is.
Oh, awesome. You know, that's my plan. Right. If somebody tries shooting at me, it's the zigzag. Right?
Yeah. You've learned that from all of the first person shooters you play, right? You duck as well and you jump and you kind of strafe left and right as you move.
It's just the theory. If somebody was shooting at me and I had to run away, I would run in zigzags, but you have to make sure your zigs and your zags are different lengths to throw them off.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You would be very good at first person shooters, Oren.
Thanks.
So that's all I got.
Awesome.
What you got?
So do you know what a translite is?
Yes, I do. And I have only had bad luck with them. But for the listeners at home.
Yeah. So a translite is a backdrop that is semi-translucent, hence the trance part of the thing. And you can light it from the front or from the back. And I guess I didn't really realize this until recently. But if you light a trance light from the front, let's say Mad Men, right? That's a perfect example where they use a ton of trance lights, right? Whenever they're in the office and John Hamm is looking out the window at the city, that is not a real city. It's a backdrop that's hanging on a soundstage. It's a giant, giant printed photograph of a city. And if you light it from the front, it is that city during the day. And if you light it from the back, it is that city at night.
And so the semi-translucent places are like windows, for instance, and streetlights and things like that. Basically, I imagine they printed on some sort of like Luma curve where the brighter a pixel is, the more transparent it is.
Well, that's what you would like think, that. Right?
But unpack it for me,
but
Oren.
But then let's say you had a backlit city during the day, so the sky would be much brighter than the buildings. So then at night, you wouldn't want the sky to be much brighter than the buildings, right? And the window lights in the buildings wouldn't be on during the day. They would be the same color as the rest of the building. So basically what you do, and so two things. One, I wanted to talk about how they work, which is you actually give them two identical images from the same angle, same shape, same everything, except one of them is the daytime image and one is the nighttime image. And usually the best way to do this is you work off a daytime image and then you Photoshop it to be a nighttime image. But you can't, like, for instance, I wanted to have a moon in the nighttime image and not a moon in the daytime image. And they said that would not work because you have to have the same shapes, just different brightness and color.
Hold on. You're giving them two images, but are they printing them onto the same fabric? Is that what's happening?
So yeah, they print the daytime one onto the front and the nighttime one onto the back. And
it's a stencil, so gotcha.
Yeah, and it's a semi-transparent material, like a plastic-type material, that when you light it from the back, this image you print on the back is kind of telling it where light can pass through and where it shouldn't. And on the front, it's just showing the image that's printed on the front. Now, also, by not lighting the front, it's darker, right? Because there's less light on it, and it effectively makes the scene feel darker as well. So I thought that was really fascinating because I didn't realize that you were literally giving them two different images that line up on each other. And we'll post a link. Like, there's this website, pacificstudios.net, that has like a bunch of translates you can rent. And usually they're quite big, like 16 feet tall and 40 feet wide, like a giant, you know, so you could have build an entire house set and the entire one side of the house faces this translite, and it's a forest or it's the neighbor's house or it's a pool or whatever.
The thing about translites, the reason that I always have a negative feeling towards them, is that you never have enough room. You're either you're seeing off the edge or you don't have enough room to light them properly. Right. So like you need to have, you know, typically when you're building a set, you know, you go ahead and put one wall pretty darn close to that fire lane, basically, or like, you know, maybe a couple yards off of the fire lane so that you could put some lights back there and blast light through, or it's no big deal. But if you want to translight out that window, you need to give yourself enough room to create distance both between the window and the translight or the backdrop or whatever to make it feel appropriate so that things fall off.
Enough room to light it from the front.
Right. Or from the back. And so all of a sudden, a wall that you'd put pretty darn close to one edge of the studio is 30 feet off the wall. And if you want to do that on, say, a wraparound set, which is what I tried to do last time and it looked bad, so we just turned the lights off. then
yeah, you need a ton of room.
Like, I'm looking like a real jackass.
I'm looking here at some that you can rent. This one, it's a cityscape. It's 20 feet tall by 63 feet wide. So can you imagine how much stage area that takes to have a 63 foot long, 20 foot high backdrop? First of all, just hanging it is quite difficult. It's heavy. Just transporting it is quite difficult. But then you need enough lights to light both sides of a 63 foot wide thing evenly. Yeah. So anyway, but the second thing I wanted to say is that you can make custom translates, and they're actually quite affordable. So we are printing ours. So we have on the set that we built that we're going to shoot this weekend, we have quite a big window. It's 4 feet wide by 8 feet tall. And then outside of that window, we want to see the exterior that this house takes place in, kind of like a foresty type environment. So we want to see the forest. And so I found like an awesome photo on one of my favorite websites, pexels.com, totally royalty free. You can use it for anything, commercial or whatever. High res photos. So I found a photo of a forest, and I then photoshopped a nighttime version of it for the back. And we're going to print it to be 10 feet wide by 12 feet tall, which based on my Blender renders allows us to have 10 feet between the set and this translite. But it's a really small translite. It's only 10 feet wide. But that's all we need to cover this window. So 10 feet by 12 feet, it's 120 square feet. And you can print a custom translite for $18 a square foot. So it's under $2,000, which I know might sound like a lot, but we're going to own this thing. Like, we could sell it or rent it or give it. I don't know. It's like to have anything you want outside the window. If you're doing a TV show, a web series, like something where you have like, you know, some issues with windows and you want to just add like another layer, depth or realism, I thought it was going to be like $10,000 to just even start talking to someone about printing a translate, and it's not. So anyhow,
pretty great. Are you layering in kind of mid ground elements in between the?
Yeah, so we're going to have a few fake trees, and then we're also going to have some characters just doing crosses.
And then also you can do window trees as well, right? So you can like have the curtains can be semi-transparent, or like you can have shears as part of it as well, all of which would be a heck of a lot harder if you were doing a green screen.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid green screen at all costs because my shot is a 17-day long shot, and I don't want to do 17 days worth of footage VFX on that shot. So
fair enough. Awesome. Well, Oren, this was another great conversation. Just you and me. We're going to have a couple new guests coming on soon, but it was good to talk about art and the nature of collaborating with agencies.
Yeah, and we'll have a production designer on at some point.
So if you have topics that you want us to cover, we've been getting a lot of good feedback recently about what to dig in on. So drop us a line at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Or you can hit us up directly on the internet. I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow on Twitter and Instagram. And we're at Just Shoot a Pod across all social media.
Yeah, I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. I'm at Smitey Pyleg on Twitter. And we are very excited to hear from you. This episode, by the way, is edited by Sarah Weirda. Our social media master is Derek Aiello. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks, everyone. We will talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.